We cover many serious issues in this podcast. This discussion may contain reference to domestic violence, sexual violence, violence against children, suicide, drug use, or graphic depictions of death or dead bodies. It is not suitable for all audiences.
Tonight on Unsolved Mysteries Rewind, two friends get together to discuss episodes of their favorite television show, Unsolved Mysteries. Will they find answers? Will anyone care? You may be able to solve a mystery.
And it's very brilliant. Okay, so far so good.
I'm recording now.
Oh, no, it's okay. Do you want me to start over?
I'm recording, so no.
Okay. All right, here we go. Hello, you are listening to Unsolved Mysteries Rewind. My name is Kim, and I am joined, as always, by my co-host Mark, who one listener described as having the soothing voice of Josh Mankiewicz with a little heart eyes emoji. Mark, how are you?
The hell does that mean?
Josh Mankiewicz?
Yeah.
He's on Dateline.
He's who?
He's a Dateline guy.
Oh.
But it was like a heart eyes emoji, like, ooh, Mark. So, you know, congratulations on that.
What did he look like? No, no, there. And I also have been told that I sound like the guy from Friends, who I don't know.
I actually can't unhear it as Ross from Friends. But
really? You know what I'm going to do? I've never watched really more than maybe two or three episodes. I'm going to watch an episode and I'm going to start quoting it.
Okay. Well, today we are talking though about season 8, episode 10 of Unsolved Mysteries. And
nice.
This is from late 95 and early 96. They kind of mashed all the episodes together.
It was around this time when Friends was pretty much a hit. As we go back to Friends.
Yeah, oh, there's worse things to sound like than David Schwimmer, but, you know, it is what it is.
It's kind of, it hurts a little bit. But, all right, moving on from the comedic aspect, we're talking about some serious stuff in this particular episode.
Yeah, but this one is a little lighter.
Well, yes and no. I don't know. I think it ends on a high note. I think that the order of the stories could have been altered a little bit, personally. Mm-hmm. They start with an episode I kind of wish that they ended with.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean. This one in particular is a little lighter.
Yeah. The Ice Woman. This is a big story, I think, right? Mm-hmm. Jean Hilliard in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
That's my Minnesota accent again. there's a lot of stuff in this episode. I actually watched my son doesn't tolerate Unsolved Mysteries really too much.
Mm-hmm.
But I said, you have to watch this one because we'll get to it. So 19-year-old Jean Hilliard is driving in Minnesota. It's minus 25 degrees.
Yeah. And with the wind chills, negative 70.
It's December 20th, 1980.
Mm-hmm.
And she's really dressed for the part. Like she looks like she's dressed in 1980. It's at least in this, it just looks like kind of like what people would dress. And for Minnesota, she's not really wearing enough layers. I think.
Right. She's definitely dressed like 1980, but not dressed like it's negative 70 with the wind chill outside. She's wearing like a jacket, some jeans, you know, shirt and some cowboy boots. And yeah, she's cute. She's doing her thing, but she does lose control with her car on an icy road and she runs into a ditch and she cannot get the car back on the road.
Now, in these type of situations, I would just imagine she would know to like take her floor mats out and kind of stuff them under the wheels and try to get some traction. It's possible she tried that. I don't know if you've ever been broken down in freezing cold weather, but, you know, your hands just, you know, become useless after about 5 minutes. I would imagine a minus 20. I'm talking, in my experiences, when it's in the teens here, we're talking 30 degrees less. So I couldn't imagine, personally, being in negative 25 degree weather.
Yeah, it's crazy. One time when I was a caterer, I catered an outdoor wedding at negative 12, and I thought I was going to die. I've never been so cold in my life. It was so miserable, and we didn't even get tipped.
Oh, my God. A negative, All right, it was negative 12 and it was an outdoor wedding?
It was like in a barn, but it was an actual barn. So it wasn't like, oh, this is a barn that has heating or anything. It was just like a barn for the shelter. And oh my gosh, I was like, I was so cold. And we had to wash dishes there at the end of the night. So to warm them up, we would have to run water through the coffee maker and add it to the bucket to try and just keep it warm.
What?
And as we're putting the like china, this like fancy wedding china away on the drying rack, the drips are freezing and the rack like kept sliding and sliding because it was just on ice. I have never been so cold in my entire life. It was miserable.
When you get really warm and you start thinking, oh, it's so hot here in Florida, do you go back to this memory of being so cold?
No, that's a good idea, though. No, I just remember like when I came home, Jack was sleeping and I just like stole all of his warmth. I was just like putting my hands under his shirt and stuff.
You're like Elsa.
Yeah, I was so cold, but not as cold as a negative 25 degrees.
Yeah, and I couldn't imagine it. Her car is broken down. She just can't get it out. So she goes and walks. She's afraid to stay in the car.
Yeah, she's afraid, you know, as a single woman, she doesn't want some bad guy to come up on her or get carbon monoxide poisoning.
In negative 25 degrees, though. I mean, it's kind of an unrealistic scenario.
I mean, we have dealt with murders that have happened in blizzards before, so I wouldn't be surprised.
I guess. It's just... It just makes more sense to me that she should stay in the car. And if she's afraid of carbon monoxide, roll down the window every 10 minutes, you know?
And keep in mind, she's 19, and her friend's house happens to be like a mile and a half away. So she's like, I'm just going to huff it. I'll be there in no time. Or hoof it. I should say not huff it. But she's like, it took her like an hour to walk the mile and a half because it is so cold. And she said, like, I didn't even register the coldness hitting my body. And she like is stumbling up to her friend's house. She's only 15 feet away from the house. And she sees the Christmas lights and everything, and then that's the last thing she remembers. So
it was kind of a sad little moment because, you know, it's you finally made it, and then you just kind of collapse.
I know. How sad is that? So close. So in the morning, her friends, like, open up the windows. They're like, oh, what's that lump out there? So they go and, like, turn it over.
The dog runs out and pees on, you know.
Yeah. they turn her over, and this is like the spookiest thing ever. I have pulled the gif. I will put it on Unsolved Mysteries Rewind podcast on Facebook. But they roll her over, and she just like her eyes are open and all frosted over.
She blinks a few times, though. They reenact her. But, you know, she probably has crazy white contacts in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be really irritating. And you said that her face was frozen in an icy white grimace.
Yeah, that's the way it's described by. I don't know if it's being narrated by Robert Stack, but I think it was. And the way he said that just kind of made me think. It reminded me of the last episode with the poisoning.
I know, the strychnine poisoning.
Yeah, that stuck with me. A couple of these things, I'll say from time to time, they kind of come up in my mind. And when I heard Icy White Grimace, I just thought, oh, man, it just seems so sad. But when they roll her over, she kind of looks like a mannequin.
Yeah, I was wondering if that was a mannequin or not, because her stiff work is amazing. Like, she is not really moving, except, like you said, the occasional blink. But they ship her off to this, like, small little local hospital, and the hospital workers kind of describe, like, how cold she was. And all the time, they are putting, like, hot water bottles on her and covering her in blankets and stuff. They said that she had a very faint heartbeat, but it was so slow that she should be dead.
So she's in a state of hypothermia. Right.
Yeah. And she would take 2 to 3 shallow breaths per minute. Her veins were so frozen that doctors couldn't get a pulse. And she was so cold that the thermometer couldn't even register her temperature, which means that her internal temperature had to be below 80 degrees.
I just don't know how somebody survives this.
I have no idea. It's crazy, the stuff about this. Like, she is a medical marvel because no one knows what the heck happened.
We also, normally, you know, frostbite would make it so that the limbs would never, ever be able to be used again. You know, the circulation would just be shot. And I don't know. I mean, they froze and then they defrosted. They show a reenactment of what they look like. And it's, I'm terrible with this kind of thing. I can't look at this. But
I was shocked that she didn't. Oh, yeah. Well, she didn't even have a single toe, like, amputated. Like, she didn't have any issues because frostbite is what happens when ice crystals form in your veins and just start tearing it up and destroying the tissue. And she also had hypothermia, which is when your organs, including your brain, get so cool that they stop until you just die.
It's the whole thing is just, it's amazing. It really is amazing. And she made, from what we can tell anyway, a form of a full recovery, which now they credit it to a prayer circle.
Right. So this like clerical employee at the hospital is like, we need some Jesus in here stat.
Right.
So she is like calling people, telling them to pray for her. And within 10 minutes, 30 people are praying for her. And that's what pretty much everybody is crediting for her recovery. However, the wonderful and reliable Snopes.com said that.
I like that you add a chuckle when you see Snopes.
Well, it's, I don't know.
It's right up there with World Weekly News, in my opinion.
Oh, well, okay. But
they get things right.
It says here that immediately after the incident, most of the stories published credited the electric heating pads and oxygen tanks for her recovery. But with each retelling of the story, it became more miraculous. So when World Weekly News published their version of the story in January 1981, quotes from Hilliard's parents were added that credited her recovery to the power of prayer. And Guidepost Magazine took it a step further, claiming that the prayer chain had saved Jean Hilliard's life. And of course, Unsolved Mysteries, it's pretty much, oh my gosh, this is a prayer miracle.
Well, if there's one thing we've learned from Little House on the Prairie, it's that faith is very important. So yeah. if this reinforces their faith in their higher powers, then, you know, I'm willing to accept that.
Want to disrespect anybody's beliefs or anything, but it did also remind me of Little House on the Prairie when Mr. Edwards comes with the Christmas presents and he is like frozen solid. Yeah.
He looked more cold, actually, in those big red long johns. But yeah, I did get a copy of the Weekly World News, and it did not make the cover story. That would be Hitler's secret UFO plans, which, of course, I think we even discussed in the past. A little bit. It's definitely snuck its way into, I think, our UFO story. But that's in the archives, so you can go dig through that. I'm amazed. I think that she still lives in Minnesota, which I think is, get out of there, maybe. I don't know. Go to Florida where you don't freeze.
Maybe. Yeah, I don't know. But she spent 49 days in the hospital, but she completely recovered. Not a single thing. I know.
It's a month and a half. Like, that's just crazy to me, but you know,
I know
that's amazing. It is on paper, a miracle, I guess.
Yeah. And she credits the prayer chain, but, you know, maybe a little bit for the nurses and doctors.
And the oxygen tank and heating pads, you know, exactly. When they were using the water bottles, I immediately thought that's the best you got.
You know, I got the impression that this was very small town, like, doctor's office instead of like a hospital. Like, I don't know.
Fill a tub with hot water.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know what that would do to her, if that would burn her or something. Yeah. You know, considering it's like a slow but steady.
Oh, that's a good point. My son had a great idea. He said, "Why don't they boil her?" So that's a good idea. Not going into the medical field, but but yeah, I mean, it's a miracle. She, like you said, she's still around.
Yeah, but somebody who was not so lucky is 24-year-old Sue Taraskowicz, and she is in Boston, Massachusetts, and we are going back to April 1989 here.
Yeah, poor Sue. Her nickname is SU, which the whole time I'm seeing, there's a shot later where she opens her locker where there's graffiti and says SU, and I'm like, what the hell does SU mean? And didn't click.
Yeah, I had to find and replace all my SUEs to SU because that is her nickname. But, you know, she's working in the very male-dominated field of ground service for airplanes. Mm-hmm. She is the second woman hired by Northwest Airlines to even do this at Logan Airport.
Which is great. You know, that means that she has a focus. Maybe they're, you know, at the time at least more progressive enough to give women a chance, because guess what? You know, women can do the same job.
yeah, I mean, I agree with you that women could do the same job. I don't necessarily agree with you that Northwest is some, like, feminist icon with what we know later.
Well, no. But I think for 1989 standards, maybe they were.
Well, we'll see how we feel at the end of the story. But we have Sue's mother, Marlene Taraskowitz.
Don't talk bad about Northwest. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, sorry. Well, the now defunct Northwest. Yes. But, Sue's mother is Marlene. She says Sue loved her job. And if you listen closely, you can hear the glass ceiling shatter as Sue works her way up to ramp supervisor in February of 1992. And she is the first woman ever to hold that position. Going back just a bit to April of 1989, we get introduced, Unsolved Mysteries Rewind listeners, to a man we will call Joe N. Joe happened to be in a fist fight. He's another worker there. He's in a fist fight with two other baggage handlers. Sue steps in, breaks it up, and Joe calls her an effing C word. So Sue reported this, and he was actually suspended for 6 months without pay. And ever since then, he has just been, like, nursing this hatred towards her. And
yeah, because it's so acceptable to call somebody that and not have any repercussions.
And it's all his fault, but somehow he makes it her fault. So during this suspension, Joe keys her car, slashes her tires, made several anonymous phone calls to
allegedly,
her.
Allegedly.
This I'm is kidding. All right,
papers. It's probably definitely her, but it really just could have been anybody. I mean, it seems like she had a lot of enemies.
Well, we'll see. But he drove by her house with a friend, and he noted how dark her street was and that she was going to pay.
Right.
So fast forward a little bit, we're in September 14th of 1992, and Sue's car is discovered abandoned in an auto body shop 4 miles away from the airport that she works at. And there appears to be blood coming out of the trunk. Mm-hmm. Now, the police open it, and they find Sue's body. Sue has been severely beaten and stabbed multiple times.
I take back what I said.
Well, she wasn't robbed or sexually assaulted, so her family kind of thinks that this is like a random act of violence. No telling. So a year passes, even more time, and it's Christmas 1993, and Marlene works up the courage. Marlene, the mom, works up the courage to go into Sue's room for the first time.
Like, yeah, this was a very emotional little scene that they created or recreated.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. I would be willing to say that's actually her bedroom with all the Snoopy stuff and everything.
It didn't click until just now. Do you think that really is?
I think it might be. It might be. But I don't know. I don't know if Marlene would let the reenactor Marlene go in there. You know, it's like a very sacred space to her. But
seems
she
a little creepy. I mean, I know, you know, I couldn't imagine losing a child, but especially in such a heinous way. But to hold on to all that, it just seems a little bit unhealthy, personally.
I hear so many times about parents who keep the bedroom the same exact way. They don't want to wash anything. They don't want to... I mean, can you imagine packing it up and everything and putting it away or giving it away? That's horrifying.
Yeah, I guess I would just hire a service or something. But it's just... I don't know. I would have a hard time having a constant reminder. And I guess that's... Yeah. But you know what? Sometimes you hold on to things and you discover things that might be able to indicate what happened and shine a light onto it.
And like the thing is, Sue's not here anymore. So this is the last little bit of like new undiscovered Sue stuff for her mom. So maybe her mom's just trying to savor it, you know, for as long as she can, like there's bits of her daughter's life. But she goes into her closet and Marlene, the mom, spots a briefcase. She opens it up and in it, she finds a diary. Now, in this diary, Sue had documented multiple accounts of horrendous sexual harassment that happened to her at Northwest that she never told her family about. In the men's room and even the cargo hold of jets, there was crude graffiti about her, including a giant portrait of her naked, quote, in a sexual position.
Yeah, this is, I mean, reading about this, about your child after her murder, I couldn't imagine. I mean, she, you know, her blood pressure probably went through the roof. It's just the whole thing. It's just crazy. And for her to be documenting this, we were saying that it's possible that this wasn't, well, I said that I don't know if this is a conventional diary. Like today I, you know, drank a Coca-Cola.
Yeah, I don't think so.
I think this was a real record of bad behavior, and it extended to go on for so long that she actually had to bring in a new book.
Yeah, it's so sad. It's so, it's so upsetting. But did you, I want to tell you a story here? Yeah.
All right. I mean, this is just one of these funny things I bring up from time to time, which I think is kind of funny, having to do with my wife and I when we were dating. So there was this pub that was near where I used to work in Manhattan called, you know what? I don't know what the pub was called, but everybody referred to it as the Shark Bar. It's like down in like Soho. And the reason they called it Shark Bar is because there's taxidermy sharks everywhere. And I just don't, nobody really knew what the name of the pub was. So she met me in the city one day and we went there, you know, and we're just hanging out. And it's just us. And she went to go use the ladies' room and she came out all like kind of pissed off. And I'm like, what's wrong? She's like, on the, you know, I'm using the bathroom and I look on the wall. And it says, I'm going to have Mark in my last name's baby.
Oh, my God.
With all these hearts. Yeah. And then underneath it said, yeah, me too.
What?
Yeah. And I have no idea who wrote this to this day.
Oh, my gosh.
But I would go there with all my coworkers. So it was, clearly it was like something where we were just joking around. And female friends who are using the bathroom were probably like saying how wonderful I am. No, but you know, it's like, so, but you know, bringing your girlfriend, you know, into your world, that's, you know, there and then having her see it on the wall is, it's a tough one to live through. And I'll here bet. We are decades later and it still gets brought up in a sore way.
does.
But, oh I never God, had any affairs with any of my colleagues.
Oh, well, that's good to know. wow, that's great.
But if you're listening to this, I'd love to know who you are.
Oh, God, let's no, sleep and dogs lie.
No, but it's just one of those things where that's exactly what it was, though. I mean, it was just kind of somebody had a couple too many drinks, and they thought it would be kind of funny to do that and then add a me to it in another period of time.
Well, that sounds a lot sweeter than what happened here. I know you're not comparing apples and oranges. I'm just trying to segue back into
nobody died history. In my situation. And nobody, that. Yeah. And I was victimized. So.
Oh, Lord. Well, in as far as
I was not victimized. I'm kidding. I'm no. sorry. Let's go. Let's get back into this story.
Okay, so Sue's mom thinks that now Susan was probably murdered by one of the airline employees. And I don't think she's wrong, but dang, that's brave to go out there and say on television. So one of many disturbing entries in her diary involves a man named Bobby. Bobby comes into the break room and just picks up her radio that she's listening to and smashes it.
Which is insane. Like, that just really bothered me so much.
Yeah, it's horrifying. The reenactment did kind of make me laugh because it's so silly, but like it's just blatant harassment. It's crazy.
I didn't think it didn't make me laugh until the next level of it. Actually.
Right. So another employee's like, oh, let's see if it's still working and plugs it in. And then Bobby comes right back in and smashes it against the wall. And she goes, what'd you do that for? And he's like, the Bruins lost. I mean, in the reenactment, again, yes, this is not a funny thing, but the reenactment was kind of funny. So what they don't tell us on Unsolved Mysteries, but they do tell us in court records, which is where I got all this info from.
Thank God you read these things. I tried to read through them, and I'm just, like, thinking about what I have to do later. Like, my mind is just wandering.
They can get a little heavy, but Sue and Bobby had previously engaged in, quote, two sexual dalliances. Yeah, so Sue's boyfriend at the time, who's also a co-worker there, spoke to Bobby and was like, you're going to replace her radio. So Sue confronts Bobby later that day and is like, how's that radio coming along? And reenactment Bobby just is like, you're just having your boyfriend do all the dirty work for you. He's like, yeah, I don't go kill him. Like, so yeah. Sue's like, get out of here.
And I know it was just a reenactment, right? But you just had this, like, kind of this attack practically on your property. Is it really appropriate to go to the person just a few minutes later and say, hey, how's our radio coming along?
I mean, you know, this isn't...
It's not like there was Amazon where you're like, I ordered it. It'll be there on Tuesday.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, I would let him cool off, I guess, if it was me. But I'm also, like, a lot meeker than this. The thing is, when you're, like, this female trailblazer, you have to be twice as tough and twice as hard and not take any bit of crap, you know?
And she was. I think she was a tough person.
Yeah, I do, too. Thank goodness for that.
And I don't think it came across, though. I don't. I'm sorry to cut you off. I don't think that Unsolved Mysteries really pushed how tough in a good way. I don't think that being tough is... You know, sometimes people say, oh, well, the woman's tough, and immediately everyone's like, well, that means you're calling her a bitch. No, being tough just means that you're kind of trying to get the job done as well as possible.
Exactly. But, I think that she was like, if I don't do this right, they're never going to probably hire another woman to do this, you know? Mm-hmm. So she actually filed many complaints to Northwest and to her union. But not only was nothing done about it, the airline punished her by forcing her to empty the airline toilets in retaliation for the formal complaint.
I would just think that would be part of her job, personally.
Well, it was when she was doing the cabin cleaning crew, but not to be the supervisor and clean out the toilets and stuff.
No, but
like
the way I think the way they empty the toilets is it's on the outside because it's you know, it's they just stick the hose in it, I think.
But I don't think that's a supervisor thing.
Oh, you're right. I mean, yeah, I guess, yeah, I'm thinking of her as the person who's like, you know, parking the planes.
Yeah, no, this is, yeah, well, she was in the beginning, but not in 92. Yeah. So the abuse escalates and escalates. There's a lot of graffiti and some are even death threats against those who support Sue. Mm-hmm. So Sue also in this diary is documenting the anonymous phone calls that she receives. Her car's vandalized, her boyfriend's car's vandalized, and the airline workers who support her's cars are vandalized.
Yeah, that's so, it's getting insane at that point. Like, you, you just friends of hers or people who are like, yeah, you shouldn't let this go. Well, you know, you're getting your car keyed or whatever.
It's so crazy. And it's all covered up, being covered up, you know? So her diary actually only covered the first 8.5 months of her job, but the harassment continued, which to me says there's another notebook somewhere that somebody found and got rid of.
Do you think that she was like Dwight Schrute with the book? Or, I mean, not Dwight Schrute. the actor BJ, I forget his name on the show, Ryan Howard, where he's keeping notes. You think she was like, well, I'm putting it in my book.
I would. Oh, my gosh.
No, but I mean verbally, you know, but I'm just saying that would... I could see how that would be kind of antagonizing to somebody who is not stable.
Right. But, like, you should, you know, you should be put on notice, especially if this is your manager, you know, like, I agree with you that don't poke the bear, but then the bear shouldn't be there. You know what I mean? It's not on her fault for poking the bear.
I look at two things. I look at, well, there's a formal complaint. Okay. And she clearly tried to do that and it didn't work. So instead, she's creating this log, you know, this off the record log. And I don't know. There's one seems to be more annoying than I could just see her. It's like, well, I'm going to put it in my book and it's going to be there and I'm going to bring all of this stuff that you're doing. And I'm just wondering if that's one of those things that kind of triggered somebody.
Right. But again, like, I don't think we can put it on her.
And doesn't, of course, should never end in murder. You know, like,
right.
You know, if anything, it would be at most an argument.
Right.
In real life.
Yeah. So, you know, she does have the promotion and she's in charge of all these people who are harassing her. And she was originally passed up for the job when a man in the union illegally bid for the job. I'm not sure how that works, but she filed a grievance and she won. So we get to meet Joseph Snow and Deborah Mazakis, and Sue, they're Sue's co-workers, and they just describe kind of how people had a problem with a woman being in charge.
Yeah, now, which doesn't make sense to me. I mean, I was just saying, it's the job seemed to be really an administration type thing.
Yeah, at this point it is. But, you know, at this point, I found this morning that Joseph Snow and Deborah Mazakis were actually fired by Northwest Airlines for cooperating with the state's investigation into Sue's death. And around the time of this episode, they filed the lawsuit against Northwest Airlines because they were fired for supporting her, talking to the police about what happened. So it sounds like this is a huge, allegedly, Northwest cover-up.
It sounds almost like maybe there's a legal moratorium on it.
Yeah, I don't know. But, you know, these people, they, around the time of this lawsuit, they're going on Unsolved Mysteries. These two people have been on Dateline before. They're not exactly making their company look great, but good for them for speaking up for what's right.
I couldn't agree more with that. I mean, it's kind of, you know, you have to do the right thing at the end of the day. It's just, I'm just kind of curious if, you know, Northwest was like, maybe they even have like non-disclosure about things that go on.
Probably. I feel like I've had to sign a non-disclosure almost every place I've worked at.
Yeah, I definitely have. I'm in one forever. Like, you know, one is just, it doesn't expire.
Dang. Well,
it's an entertainment one. That's why.
Oh, okay. Well, one day Sue opens her locker and there is a coffin graffitied on the inside of her locker with her name on it. It's like a coffin.
It was scary, but I thought it was,
what?
I don't know. When I saw it, I was like, it's so juvenile.
But these people not only are saying you're going to die, but they're inside of her locker, her personal space.
I guess I find scribbling and graffiti to be more scary to me than somebody who took the time to draw a coffin. That's all.
Yeah, but it's also like picking her lock, getting in her locker, going through her stuff. Like, it's a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
So Deborah, the other woman who worked there, tells us that Sue was afraid and she caught her crying in the bathroom one time. And in the reenactment, Sue's like, how can I be crying? Like, we promised we wouldn't cry on the job because we are strong women.
Yeah, like she broke the rule. I was like, well, it's an unspoken rule. I'm not really sure what that was all about.
It was like a rule that Deborah and Sue had together. That, like, we're going to be tough women and we are not going to let these guys get to us. So we learned that on August 4th of 1992, some baggage employees were operating a stolen credit card ring, and the alleged ringleader of this is Joe N., who we talked about before. So we're both not super sure how this scam works, but workers would steal shipments of new credit cards and use them and sell them.
And you know what? Airports, I mean, you know what? With all the new laws and everything, I'm not 100% sure, but I have friends who worked in different airports and different things. There are so many scams. It is so shady. It's ridiculous. Like, things that go missing. And
I bet.
It is. I mean, it is just crazy. But I don't. I was just saying, I don't know how this scam would work. Because I know even in the early 90s, you had to activate a credit card with personal information. So, you know, I have a feeling maybe it was something a little bit darker than just stolen credit cards.
I could totally see that, but we do know that this scam netted them over $7 million.
That's what I mean also. I mean, you're not getting up to $7 million with, you know, $5,000 credit lines.
Yeah, but I don't know. I really, this was like the least of my worries with all of this information. We do know that 10 employees on August 4th are indicted. And again, the ringleader is Joe. Now, Unsolved Mysteries tells us as a fact that some of the scammers were ratted out by Sue. However, this is only what Joe thought, that it was Sue who ratted him out, and this has never been proven. In fact, the FBI has actually said specifically she wasn't cooperating with them in any way, shape, or form. So shame on Unsolved Mysteries.
So she's not a rat. I mean, the bottom line is, even with all of this going down, she's still, I mean, maybe she didn't know who they, you know the situation, but if she did, she didn't rat anyone out.
Exactly. But she got all the blame for it, even on this episode of Unsolved Mysteries. So I know it's so unfair. In later in August, on August 13th, Joe N. is actually fired for his part in the credit card scam. And Joe pisses and moans to anybody who will listen to it up until September. Like, he is just like, I hate her. That C word. She is a rat. Blah, blah, blah. Now, on August 25th, that guy, Bobby, the radio breaker guy, he was actually granted a transfer to Minnesota. Now, on September 12th of 1992, this is 2 days before Sue's body is discovered.
And this is all within a 3-week period.
Yeah. Oh, a lot's going on. Yeah. At 1 a.m., Sue gets a phone call from an unidentified person who said that they wanted to meet with her. She's during graveyard shift, and she's like, hey, guys, I'll get you sandwiches from that roast beef place. Yeah, you know. Exactly. Yeah, here, hold the mayo or whatever. So she's like, all right, guys. So she leaves, never returns. No one on the job reported her missing for a day and a half. In fact, they even clocked in her time card to make it look like she returned from getting sandwiches, A, and B, that she later clocked out that morning. So Sue's mom's like, why did nobody report her missing?
You know, I would imagine, yeah, graveyard shift, the whole thing, it's a little shady because they did clock her out. If they didn't clock her out, then I wouldn't be so suspicious.
I agree.
You know, with graveyard shift, people vanish for like 2 days. You know, it's the sleep patterns are off.
Look at Dave Box. It's a similar situation with Dave Box. And like, oh, your buddy gets to the time card place before you. Why don't you clock him back in after that lunch? You know, she went to go to the roast beef place. Maybe she's running late.
Can I share a quick story? This is happening right now. This is today. So where my wife works, it's a local, like, huge nursing home, right? So she has one particular employee who has not showed up for 3 days.
What? Okay?
Well, today would be fourth day because I asked her about this morning. I'm like, did he show up? And said, no. So 2 days ago, one of the employees, she learned that he didn't show up for 2 days at this point. So, he's not responding to calls or emails or anything. And he's somebody in a bit of a, you know, middle management type situation. He lives somewhat local. So they sent somebody there to just check in, you know, who knows what's going on, you know, with everything happening. He goes there and his, rings the doorbell and the wife comes and she's all weird. And she goes, he's home. He's fine. He's fine. Like all very dismissive. And she picks up her phone. And she's like, I'm really busy. I can't talk. He's fine. He'll be back when he's back. And just kind of slams the door obnoxiously. This really happened just a couple days ago.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So my wife is like, he's dead on the kitchen floor. She killed him.
Yeah.
You know, that's what she thinks. But, the, you know, they actually gave a call because they have a lot of ins on the local police and everything. It's like, can you guys do anything? It's like, well, you guys did a wellness check. You're a healthcare facility and you did a wellness check because through the wife, and that's legal. And it's like, we really can't, we'd be overstepping at this point. He has to be missing for X amount of time.
Oh my God.
So I think by tomorrow they can go check on him, but she, you know, there's all these rumors, like maybe he won the lottery and he doesn't want anyone to know, or,
oh my God,
or he's dead on the kitchen floor. And
yeah, I'm going with that one. Well,
so I'll keep you updated on that one.
I sure hope so. Oh my gosh. That's crazy.
I said, this would be great for the show.
Honestly. And we hope he's fine, but yeah.
No, honestly, I don't know the guy. So, I don't have anything to gain except a decent story. But yeah, I do hope he's okay. But anyway, I'm sorry. I'm diverging a lot with my stories of sharp cars and possible murder scenes.
Well, talk about possible murder. Well, this is actually a definite murder, but Northwest Airlines declined Unsolved Mysteries request to come on.
Real now shady.
But we do know that Sue's family settled a sexual discrimination lawsuit against Northwest Airlines, which I do have the details
of. It's one of the largest settlements, I heard.
That's what I hear. But Northwest, which is now absorbed into Delta, had to pay Sue's family $75,000 for sexual discrimination against Sue. And they have to put up a $250,000 reward for information leading to an arrest in her murder.
That's a lot of money, right?
Yeah, that's one of the most we've ever done. And usually they don't like it to get that high because then people start calling, you know, with all kinds of BS just trying to get the money. So they, in, you know, as part of the lawsuit, they don't have to admit to any wrongdoing. Now, we do have a lot, which I'll try and condense because I know we are kind of running short on time. But in 1995, Bobby fully cooperates, the radio guy, with the whole credit card scam, and he was granted a term of parole. So Joe, who we all see as the ringleader, is sentenced to 3 years in prison for the credit card scam. In fall 1996, Bobby is called to testify in front of the murder grand jury on Sue's case. He gets a limited immunity deal, and he testifies that Joe blamed Sue for his 6-month suspension, and that Joe more than once expressed his staunch belief that Sue was a snitch who, quote, blew the whistle on the credit card scheme. So Bobby also testified at the time of Sue's murder that he was at work at the airport in Minnesota, and that he hadn't talked to Joe all weekend. Now we're in June 1997. The police have the receipts that Bobby was not at work at the night of Sue's murder and that he was also in contact with Joe the entire time. So he is charged with 3 counts of perjury and 2 counts of obstruction of justice, and he gets 18 months in prison. In 2017, Marlene's like, I'm a very healthy woman. Like, you better watch your back.
She's another badass mom, by the way. She gets the award of the, at least the episode, yeah, where she's not willing to give up for her child.
Exactly. You know, she would like do a motorcycle mom, yes, Dust Hoffman's mom situation and like infiltrate the inner workings.
So, yeah, she's a good mom. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, she's like, I'm not going anywhere. There's no statute of limitations, so I will be here to get justice for my Sue. Also, there is a Ripped from the Headlines episode of Law and Order Criminal Intent, yeah, called Baggage, which is not available online. But if that story sounds familiar, that might be why.
Oh, man. I want to see that one. You also had an interesting thing how Charles Schultz, and this gave me a little lump in the throat, Charles Schultz hand drew a Snoopy holding a rose, which is on her tombstone.
Yeah, she was, like, obsessed with Snoopy. We see all the Snoopies in her room and all the, you know, Charlie Brown stuff. And she wanted to be a cartoonist, and she had actually met Charles Schultz before. So he drew that little Snoopy, and we will post a picture of that on the Facebook page.
Yeah, that just makes me think Charles Schultz, pretty good guy.
I think so, too. But, yeah, so now we go to – that one's kind of a case of, like, wink, wink, we know who did this, but we don't really have enough info on it, allegedly. And we are going to the complete opposite with Silicon Valley Hit, or Silicon, which most of this info I got from East Bay Times, an article called Death in a Public Place.
Now, I think this is a real cut and dry type of simple case. I do think this is a case of just identifying the wrong person.
Yeah, so we have... In March 24th of 1994, 26-year-old veteran, squeaky clean, not an enemy in this world, Matt Flores.
Good-looking guy, too. Like, I always judge people on this kind of stuff.
No lie, probably the most handsome guy we've ever covered in this. Like, I was like, okay.
That's what my wife said. She's like, oh, he's a good-looking guy. And I'm like, you know.
He's a veteran. Yeah. He's handsome. He looks like a G.I. Joe. Like, he's got the bluest eyes I've ever seen.
And he's probably smart because he's an engineer at Applied Materials, yeah, Inc., which is a huge company.
And the police and everybody have investigated. They said he wasn't into gambling. He wasn't into drugs. He didn't have a side piece. Like, this guy was straight laced. He is the father to little 8-month-old Danielle and the husband to Denise Flores. He had been honorably discharged a month before this, and he starts working for a computer company called Applied Materials Incorporated, which is still around today.
Yeah. They're huge. Like, they've always been in the computer industry.
Humongous. And this, he was actually shot on the 9th day of his new job. So he drives to work like normal on the morning of his death, and he is in a company-rented white Chevy Corsica. It's like a little sedan, white with like that little black trim around it. Right. And Matt arrives for work at 8:12 a.m., and he parked in a random spot. These spots are not assigned. He stepped out of his car, bent down to put his jacket on, and he was shot at point-blank range. Another employee who was in the parking lot just, like, killing time before she had to go check in is, like, here's the shot, and she runs over, and she sees Matt crumpled next to his car. So she's like, ooh, this does not look good. So she runs to a shuttle bus that, it, like, drives the people to work to try to get somebody on board to call for help. You know, it's 94. Not everybody has a cell phone.
Yeah. I mean, 94, nobody has a cell phone. I mean, not nobody, but I mean, this guy doesn't have a cell phone. He's kind of just starting. You know, he's probably pretty broke. It's a very strange type of thing. And I think that for this to happen on the campus of this particular business is kind of strange. We have surveillance footage. We have a lot of things. There are things that we also know about the early days of Silicon Valley when it comes to these campuses, and you can't just drive into the parking lot. You know, this isn't Costco. Mm-hmm. This is this is a secure facility. This isn't, you know, this 1994, things are already moving forward. So I find it hard to believe that we don't know absolutely everybody who was not only in the parking lot, but in the, you know, in the general vicinity.
Yeah, this stinks. This whole case stinks, I tells you.
Now, I have a theory as to, they didn't release the actual footage of the cars driving around. Yeah, but I think I figured out why.
Hit me.
I think they were saying it might be a 1991 and 1994 Ford Explorer. And I have not found evidence of this. I'm trying to dig around, but is it possible it was a security car? Because there's no doubt that there would be security patrolling the area. No doubt about it. And there would also be guards letting people in and out. There's no doubt about it.
Okay, so, didn't think about that. That's a great idea. And I could definitely see that happening.
And it's the only thing that would be visual where you'd be like, well, it's clearly somebody from security.
Well, I will send you a link and I will post this on the Facebook page. I believe that I saw some of the actual surveillance footage because it did not match up with the Unsolved Mysteries surveillance footage. It was in a news article like 25 years after his death and not a news article, but like a news segment. And the parents were still wanting to find justice. So I believe that I saw some of the actual footage. From what I understood, it was like a Dale Kerstetter situation.
Gotcha.
Where they would just like flip from camera to camera to camera. And it was just so random. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's why they didn't show it to us. But we learned that he was shot within 2 feet. Now there are no blanks anywhere. There is nothing. This is like a clean murder, which has a lot of people thinking like maybe it's a hit. So the parking lot had a ton of cameras, like you said. This killing happened to take place in a camera blind spot, which is like, if it is a random killing, how lucky can you be?
Yeah.
If you're the killer. But the police were able to capture what they think is the suspect's car. And this is the Ford Explorer that Mark was just talking about. So authorities asked Unsolved Mysteries not to air the tape, but they decided to recreate it shot for shot,
Like it might have been fun to film because you know, it's like these cars is driving around. It's like, just drive around. but you know, with the quality and everything, that's another questionable thing as to what kind of details would really be. We've seen surveillance and it's awful sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. So this all kind of goes down in like 20 minutes. So it's 7:52 a.m. A two-door sports model, 91 to 94 Ford Explorer with black trim comes into the parking lot and is actually facing one of the cameras. Now, a few seconds later, a white Ford Probe, which kind of looked like what Matt was driving, drove down the same lane that Matt later drives down. And the Explorer backs out and follows the car. So it's like 8:10 a.m. now. The Ford Explorer exits the parking lot.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't Matt, wasn't the guy they were looking for. 8:11 a.m., the Ford Explorer re-enters the parking lot and heads over to where the shooting actually occurred. At 8:12 a.m., two small white cars enter the parking lot, and one of them is driven by Matt. One is driven by that lady who was just killing time listening to the radio in her car. Now, at 8:14 a.m., Matt is murdered, and 20 seconds later, the Ford Explorer is quickly, like, leaving the parking lot, like, squealing out of the parking lot. So we learn that Gary R., who's the man who hired Matt, hears, like, this commotion and runs outside. Somebody was like, his wallet. Like, who is this guy? We need to take his wallet. So he grabs Matt's wallet while Matt is like dead laying there. And he's like, oh, I'm just going to bring it inside.
That's a weird, very weird thing to do.
Yeah. To bring it inside is weird. So 10 minutes later, Gary calls Denise, who is Matt's wife, and is like, I need to warn her. Like, what if people are after her?
Which is just so kind of a weird thing also. It's kind of.
Yeah.
Why? Like. When I see somebody get shot in the middle of a parking lot, probably the last thing I'm thinking is I have to contact the spouse to warn them because the chance of this person coming and getting hurt.
And
unless
there
was something going on in the,
sure that Denise was still in Rhode Island at the time. And obviously Matt was here in California because this was like a brand new job. So it makes no sense. And then after he hangs up with Denise at 8:25 a.m., he calls the police 11 minutes after Matt is shot. That is so unacceptable.
Yeah, calling the wife before the police.
Really weird.
Yeah. And again, I have to say security would have been on the facility. I'm like 99% sure that they would have security. And I would imagine security would not only be on the scene, but they would call the police.
Yeah, and like, ugh, it's so crazy.
And Silicon Valley. I mean, the police are everywhere. Yeah.
Nobody there had a cell phone that they could call to run into the building and called before 11 minutes. It makes no sense. So,
it's like Gordon Gekko from Wall Street with the big phone.
Yeah, that's what I'm picturing. but 4 minutes later, police do arrive and they pronounce Matt dead. So the Sergeant Teal, who's the guy who's talking to Unsolved Mysteries, tells us that he thinks it is a matter of mistaken identity. And Applied Materials, Inc., the company that he was working for, put up a $100,000 reward for it. And that's where Unsolved Mysteries ends. But, you know, we have some theories that have been floating around the internet. The main theory is a military cover-up. So on Unsolved Mysteries, someone who claims to be Matt's cousin, on unsolved.com, claims to be Matt's cousin, says that it's a military cover-up, and that's what the family thinks. But you can make up anything online.
Yeah, I don't, there's really nothing verifiable there.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, there is a guy named Nicholas Gange. He was actually under Matt's command when Matt was in the military, and he died under mysterious circumstances. His decomposing body was found in the woods 10 months after being declared AWOL. Now, the initial investigation ruled that it was a hit and run. A subsequent investigation found that Gange had a fractured skull, no injury to the rest of his body. Now, we get a final report from the coroner, and it says no skull injury, but he had 8 broken or cracked ribs, 6 fractured vertebrae, and death occurred most likely as a result of blunt force trauma to the chest. Now, when asked, like, what's the deal with the difference between these two autopsy reports, they had no answer. And when that East Bay Times company asked for the military for copies of Matt's military records, the military officials stated that the records had vanished and could not be located.
That's interesting. It's definitely shady. It definitely seems a little bit strange. I don't know if Applied Materials is really the kind of company that would be doing anything that top level.
Well, no, I agree. But this is like, basically this theory is saying it's not Applied Material at all. Like, it has nothing to do. It has to do with
something in the military. But I just don't believe that they would allow him to even move on.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And like, be out for a month and who knows what he would have said in that time or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing you were saying is road rage, which I think is, it's plausible. I mean, you cut somebody off and they lose their mind and you don't know who you're dealing with.
But the assaulter, if we are to believe that this person is in the Ford Explorer, they got there first. So how would they know where he was going?
That's true. They were waiting, right?
Yeah, exactly.
They stole his spot or something.
Exactly. But the second, like the other theory besides those is that it was somebody at Applied Materials who had it ordered. There was another Applied Materials employee who was murdered less than a year before Matt. But it's pretty well known that he was stabbed by his 21-year-old nanny, and mm-hmm. she was convicted of it. And no one says they saw anything, even though 20 people were in the parking lot at the time. They waited 11 minutes to call the police, took his wallet inside, and Gary, the guy who hired him, and another man went to Matt's funeral, which was held in Rhode Island, and they were described as being, quote, cold and almost robotic.
Now, 11 minutes, it's a very long time.
Yeah.
When you have somebody who's just shot. You know, nobody is like saying where the car went or they saw a car leaving. I'm assuming everybody heard the shot.
Yeah.
And then you run to the car. So nobody saw that. I mean, as soon as you hear a shot, you turn to it.
Well, a lot of people are thinking that the radio listening to woman that was sitting in her car is full of it because apparently anytime the name Matt was ever said, she would like burst into sobs. And like, they think that maybe it was her, she did see who it was because this person had to go pick up a shell casing. It wasn't like they fired from inside the car and drove off, which you still would have been able to see. This person got out of the car, shot him within 2 feet, picked up the shell casing, got back in their car and peeled out. Somebody would have seen that.
Those shell casings can be hot too.
Yeah. And they're slippery little buggers too, but
they're not always easy to find. So it's like, it might've even taken a little bit of time to find them.
Let alone with all like the adrenaline and like, whoa, you know, blood pumping and stuff. I can imagine.
I like the stepfather retaliation that you were talking about.
Right. So that article from East Bay Times says that Matt's stepfather, Mike, may have been a target of the mob. And this does sound like a professional hit. Matt's stepfather was in law enforcement in Rhode Island. And so it is plausible that someone may have wanted to exact revenge.
That's a big, I mean, it's far reaching. You know, it's really not one of these things that's what it feels like. It does feel like a hit. I believe that it was a hit that was not meant for him. That's all, personally.
Oh, it's so sad. And, you know, wife Denise, still beautiful, moved on. Baby Danielle, by the way, looks just like her dad because I found her Facebook. Oh. And it's weird to note that right now she is the same age that he was when he was killed.
That's got to be tough for a child, you know, to go back and see. Like,
she's in law enforcement now, actually.
Wow.
I know. I feel like these kind of things drive you to either be a cop or a bad guy, you know. So she looks great. She's like a bodybuilder. She is doing just
fine. She's ready to kick your butt.
Yeah. Oh, I wouldn't mess with her. She's got like a six pack. But now we have Florida crime spree.
Yeah, this is a pretty crazy story. Murder suspect Albert Leon Fletcher is being taken to the courthouse and he escapes. Do we know why he's being taken to the courthouse for this particular time?
It's this case. It's this whole thing.
Okay. So
the whole crime spree that he goes on is because of that.
You see him messing with his handcuffs and he looks at the guy going, "What are you looking at?"
Yeah, don't look at me.
Now, Smith & Wesson handcuffs, they're like your standard police issue, are actually incredibly easy to pick, believe it or not. All you really need is exactly what he has, which is a little tiny piece of metal. You just kind of shove it in there and it just releases and that's that. You know what? And that's up to 15 years ago or something. I don't know if they've improved on the design. I would hope that they would have. But he escapes. And what I found interesting is that when he's running away, the officer fires a shot at him. And I'm just wondering, we learn later he's a dangerous person, but is the use of deadly force acceptable in this situation, in your opinion?
I don't think the use of deadly force is acceptable in many situations, in my opinion. But I have one word for you, and that word is Florida.
Yeah, like, you're right. Dade City.
I think Florida cops would shoot at him. I sent you a video of my sheriff.
Bobby.
Currently. Yeah, Bobby, just today.
Sheriff Bob.
If you don't like it, get out of this county. And like, I think that this is a Florida thing. But yeah, his crime spree that this all stems from starts on April 1st, 1993. He and his cousin, Douglas Porter, break into a home and they steal a ton of guns. Now, Porter is the lesser of two evils here, but he's also a lifelong felon with a criminal record dating back to 1986.
We see Stack holding a sawed-off shotgun, too, in his trench coat. He couldn't look cooler.
It was honestly pretty cool. So, like a little later the next day, it's 10 p.m., and two couples pull in front of a grocery store. And Fletcher and Porter, the two dum-dum cousins, pull in behind and start being, like, disgusting to these women. It's like, here, girl.
Yeah.
Here,
it's not even catcalling. It's just flat out, like, hey, baby. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And they're, like, hanging out. And they're literally, like, come here. Come on. Come on, baby. Like, they're being such creeps. And so the driver of the car's like, hey, man. Stop talking to my girl, you know? So the cousins take off, and this guy, David, whose name's in quotes, so it's probably not his real name, he takes off after them, and they catch up to each other, and the cousins, like, shove the shot-off shotgun in his face.
But when he pulls up next to him, two of the weakest cars, by the way, like, it's like, it's like a car chase that cannot exceed like 40 miles per hour. David reaches through his window and grabs him and pulls him. And I really like that. Except the fact that the guy he was pulling did have a shotgun. They put it in his face.
I think you're exactly right that David learned his lesson about road rage during this incident. Like, my God, he barely escaped with his life. So talking about really crappy cars, it is 12:40 a.m. now. And poor little 16-year-old Jason Hartman's getting off his shift as a worker for Chuck E. Cheese at like almost 1 a.m. He's just like working hard, trying to save up probably to buy a new car because his car won't start.
Was it definitely Chuck E. Cheese?
Yes.
I didn't know they kept hours so late.
I didn't either, but I'm assuming that's like sanitizing the ball pit and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, I know. I don't think like a bunch of 3-year-olds are like throwing a rager at 1 a.m. at Chuck E. Cheese.
That'd be nice.
I know, right? So all of a sudden, these two dum-dums come and carjack this poor kid.
I'm going to carjack the car that the guy can't start.
Exactly. And so Jason is like, see ya. And he runs out and runs back to Chuck E. Cheese. And so Fletcher's like, I'm going to steal this car. And obviously the car still doesn't start. So
in the reenactment, over. You see Chucky running up in the costume. To let him in. Yeah. That would be epic. But no, it did not happen.
Yeah. So the cousins are like, crap. So they got to get out without the car. Okay, so now it gets a little less funny because it's the same night. They're still on whatever they're on that makes them have this, like, 24-hour crime spree. But there's this quiet highway, and the cousins run into another car. And they're like, we're going to mess with this guy, and we're going to try and get the driver to stop.
This is some crackhead behavior. This is like, no, 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 we need money now, right?
Not now, but right now.
Like, they're desperate. And they're like, and I said before, this sounds like an Angel Dust or PCP or, I don't know, is Angel Dust the same thing as PCP? And like, or meth. This is some like depraved behavior right here.
Yeah. So they start shooting this guy's tires out, which forces him to stop. And they go to rob the man of the wallet, but apparently he's not moving fast enough. So they shoot him in the neck. Now, we learn that the driver is 32-year-old Nelson Medina. That is not his actual name. I don't know why Unsolved Mysteries didn't give his actual name, but maybe it's to protect the family, so we're going to say it's Nelson Medina.
Okay.
He is a husband and father of two.
And we get that family photo, and it's just, oh, my God.
The kids are young.
Yeah.
Yeah, so police are at the scene of the crime. And another officer across town just happens to see the cousins and stops them. And he looks in their car and sees, I think that there was blood and a shotgun. And he knows that there's a shotgun used in Medina's case because of the casings that were left at the scene. So I was wondering how somebody like even came across this person. But it's not as lonely a stretch of highway as they make it sound. It is outside of a real big city.
Yeah, you posted that, but I'm wondering how new is that city?
That's a good call. I don't know. I'm unfamiliar with the area. I am in Florida, but I'm several hours away from this place. So
okay.
I don't know. But like my area, I can drive in the middle of the day and maybe I'll see two other cars. Like because we are desolate out here.
Yeah. And you like it like that.
And I love it like that. But I can't anticipate. I wouldn't think that somebody would come across the scene so quickly. But somebody did, and they called the police. So the cousins are arrested, and they're scheduled to be tried separately. Porter, the lesser of two evils guy, is convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison. Now, this was actually later overturned on appeal, and he was able to plead down to second-degree murder and get 40 years in prison. And, you know, keep in mind, he's not the gun shooter. He's not the shooter.
Right. He's just the driver.
Right. So, which does make you like the same, basically.
It's still part of it. I mean, it's really hard to, you know, separate the two. But yeah, I mean, if you're not the one who pulled the trigger, who killed somebody.
It was a real technicality.
I think the guy was guilty of something, though, personally. But
oh, yeah. But Fletcher escaped before the trial could be held. So we're basically like, be on the lookout. Because apparently he has told family members he will not be taken alive.
He's good at escaping. Like, that's the thing is... and people seem to escape a lot.
Oh, yeah. I know. I've learned that, too, on this show.
More than I expected, actually.
Me, too. But there is an update. On the night that the episode aired in a rerun, a woman called in a tip that her neighbor in Florida was actually Fletcher, and he was going by the name Kevin Woodside.
You imagine making that call?
Oh, my God. I'd be so scared.
Hello, Unsolved Mysteries.
Oh, my God.
Tip line. Actually, you know, it's Robert Stack. Hey, like, yeah, how are you?
Oh, my God.
He's working the phones from 2 to 3 a.m. No, so he's on the tip line.
And, that's awesome.
Like, you know, it's like his phone next to his bed. But no, I could just imagine the amount of tension because this is a scary guy.
Yeah, exactly. And you're like, hey, that kind of looks like Kevin, our neighbor. That's so weird.
He's kind of a jerk. So maybe he had to have been a jerk to the neighbor. I mean, If my neighbor Mike, who's the nicest guy in the world, ended up on Unsolved Mysteries, I'd be very conflicted.
Yeah, but what if there's like a sweet reward?
How much? No, it's hard to say. I think Mike is a good guy.
Well, this guy, Kevin, a.k.a. Albert Leon Fletcher, is not so nice. He was arrested, but without incident, on April 29, 1996. He is given a life sentence. Now, Porter, the cousin, was released in 2011.
Yeah. He's, I guess he's been out and about, and he's kept his nose clean.
I guess so. But yeah, Porter is still in, or not Porter, sorry, Fletcher is still in prison.
Yeah, we get an updated photo from you. And yeah, I mean, these guys, they've aged, you know, they got older in this lifestyle. And it's just, whenever I see the difference between, you know, people who basically grew up in jail. I mean, because when he went in, he was pretty young. It's just really sad. Like, your whole life was just really kind of thrown away because of essentially a 24-hour bender.
Yeah, allegedly.
Well, yeah, I mean, this was definitely just the one where he got caught. But,
yeah. No, it's crazy.
The guy belongs there, definitely.
Yeah, that sounds like it. And this next story is a quickie. It is about twinless twins.
No, we're going to be extending this episode. It's going to be the 3-hour version because we need to talk about Elvis. He had a twin.
Don't mind if we do.
Jesse Presley.
Mm-hmm.
Jesse Presley, I have a feeling, might have been a little bit better looking. Just a little bit, right?
How is that possible?
It would have hurt your eyes, actually.
Honestly, I was looking at pictures of Elvis today, and I was like, God, that guy is good looking.
Such a cool looking guy, too. Like, all right, handsome, but also cool. So, but even when he was a kid, like, you can look at him and be like, yeah, that kid. You know, it's like he really just stands out among the crowd. And I think there was a lot of guilt there because of this. He's... a lot of people don't know this, but when Elvis was born, he had a twin named Jesse Garon.
Right. Jesse was born 35 minutes before Elvis, but he was sadly stillborn.
Now, I wonder, okay, you have a baby that's stillborn, right? It's got to be just tragic. And you know there's another baby in there.
Oh, my God.
Do you think that the baby's... stillborn as well, because we don't have, you know, there's a period of time where we don't have sonograms. We don't have, we have forceps and ma boiling sheets in the other room.
Exactly. Especially when you're born to an 18-year-old in a shack in Tupelo, Mississippi. But I know I was thinking about that. I was thinking how the mixed emotions of welcoming a child into this world, knowing that you have to bury your other child, like
you're in mourning by the time the next one comes.
Yeah, you must be in such a fog. Like, it is really sad headspace that I would imagine you would be in.
Yeah, but, it does seem sad. And this the sadness, I think, translated to Elvis's, a lot of people believe anyway, his self-destruction as he got older.
Exactly.
He probably was a very sensitive person. I kind of got this inkling that Elvis Presley was a deep thinker and somebody who's very deeply affected by emotions. And to think about this, to have this guilt of such success and to be so beloved. Oh,
but you have this guilt from the moment you're born, right? Because we meet another twinless twin a little bit later who said, like, what if I ate too much and that's what caused my twin to die? What if I took too much air and that's what caused my twin to die? Like, oh, my God, you should not have these thoughts when you are a fetus. Like, you have no control over this. Don't blame yourself.
And we learn about the organization called Twinless Twins.
Yeah, exactly. But they do say that, like, basically that was kind of Elvis's self-destruction, and like killing himself with food and killing himself with drugs was because he felt this guilt his whole life.
I think it was a part of it. I don't think it was the whole gamut. Like, exactly. I think he also probably had an addictive personality.
Oh, definitely. And you know, and you have enough money to fulfill those addictions too. Oh,
we speak to Larry Geller in his eerie voice. He should narrate Scooby-Doo episodes.
I absolutely hated his voice. It skeeved me out. He presents himself as Elvis's friend, but he's just his hairdresser.
Yeah, he's a hanger-oner. You know, he knew Elvis. You know, Elvis knew him, but let's just end it right there.
He went on an Elvis cruise in like 2010 to be like, hey, I touched Elvis. Like, I read that this morning. Between this episode and the last one we did on Elvis, Elvis had a lot of hangers on.
Yeah, and I'm curious how many of them were real friends. Maybe I'm hoping one, two.
I don't know.
But the whole thing with Elvis, you know, it made its way into the World Weekly News. I found that being discussed.
Oh my God.
this was like the tabloid thing, you know, Elvis is still alive. No, it's his twin.
Mm-hmm.
It's all kind of strange. Also, we speak to Dr. Peter Whitmore, who's the author of The Inner Elvis.
Yeah.
And he right, says that he basically channeled Jesse through his music.
Yeah. Mm. I wonder what that degree is in.
Elvis also said that he would hear voices in his head. That's your conscience. You know, it's, I don't, do you have friends or twins in your family? I think we've talked about this in the past.
Yeah, I have like two sets of identical twins in my family. Mm-hmm. Well, know, in like Jack's side of it, but yeah, my family.
Yeah, I mean, I have a lot of twins in my, in not only my life,
oh,
but
yeah,
in my
your
family.
Your dad's a twin.
Yeah, it was a twin. His brother's was. Still alive. But oh, wow. Identical, oh, too.
Oh my God, so he's a twinless twin. Your uncle is.
Yeah. Well, one of my closest friends is also a twinless twin. I grew up with both of them. And
that's right.
Yeah. And I don't know why, but I just have a lot of twins in my life. And I think I also mentioned there were three sets of twins in my on my father's side, in his direct family, brother, siblings.
Dang. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, my grandmother was out of control. A lot of kids there, a lot of kids. I don't know. They were trying to prove something, trying to Guinness Book of World Records or something. But it's the whole twin phenomenon has always been fascinating to me. But mm-hmm. I don't, you know, I was going to bring up to my friend Jeff and ask him about his feelings on twinless, being a twinless twin.
Mm. That's a hard conversation to have, though. That's like
it's a conversation I could have with him, though.
Yeah.
I think he would appreciate the conversation. Mm. But it's just one of those things where these are two people that were very, very close and lost each other in adulthood. I cannot mm-hmm. imagine the guilt that, you know, definitely gets carried along where you didn't even know if you would like the person, you know?
Yeah.
You assume you would, but it could also be a schmuck.
And we almost kind of get into, like, life starts at conception kind of thing here.
Oh, yeah, because totally. There's definitely that being pushed around here constantly.
Yeah, because we talk about uterine bonding here, and we get to see some actually kind of cool ultrasounds of twins, like, kissing each other, hugging each other, punching each other, like, in the womb.
It's just so cute. It's creepy and cute.
Yeah, I'll leave exactly. it at that. Exactly. But, you know, so that's just kind of, I thought that was a little pushy there, mm-hmm. but it was interesting, and we do meet another twinless twin who is named Diane. And Diane says that she was driving to work one day and she felt her twin's presence tell her to pull over on the shoulder. And within 5 seconds, a truck completely sideswiped her.
So, I mean, I'm thinking that her sister tried to kill her.
Because how could he sideswipe you if you weren't pulled over on the side of the road? I'm sorry. I'm going to be that person. Like, yeah. What?
And I was saying, like pareidolia, which is when you, an example of it is when you look at clouds. And you're like, oh, that one looks like Elvis, or that one looks like a Volkswagen right. Beetle. your mind basically wants to put things together in an organized fashion. So you take data mm-hmm. and you find things within it. And I think that's what that is. She's basically looking for the clues, and everything is a clue. And it's a little
exactly.
bit sad, but it's also the way she copes.
Yeah. So right on.
It. Yeah.
Yeah, and so we learn from Dr. Whitmore that tells us that, like, substance abuse, working too much, overeating, etc., was, again, we're back to Elvis, yeah. was because Elvis wanted to
well,
be
everything,
dead.
All roads lead back to Elvis, Kim.
Oh, just like life.
Kim was a huge, I did want to mention this, Kim, as a child, was obsessed with Elvis.
Honestly, I will post that picture again. You have to. It's new listeners.
I think you should be Elvis for Halloween.
Wouldn't that be cute? Because I could sew my own outfit this year because my mom sewed my original outfit. That would
and
be fun.
Can Jack also be Elvis?
Oh, okay. No, I know what you were going to say because I just thought it.
No, I didn't. I mean, do you think that you would, I forget his Jesse? Wife's name.
Oh, Lisa Marie?
Yeah.
Oh, wait, no, that's his
daughter. No, that's his daughter, sicko.
Priscilla.
Pervert.
I mean, not much of a difference. Less
yeah, they look
he fell
identical.
In love with Priscilla when she was 15 years old. Being a twinless twin is a sad, sad situation. And we will post links to twinless twin support groups on our Facebook page, Unsolved Mysteries Rewind Podcast, Facebook.com, Twinless Twin Support Group International, or twinlesstwins.org. And it seems like a really nice, happy organization.
And Deanna is still around. Her sister... was Santa. Not, you know, she no more car accidents from what we know up to this yeah. point. No, but I'm goofing a little bit. But I do think she probably does feel this kind of kinship, and she does have this connection. And
sure.
I hope I'm wrong. You know, I hope maybe it is a sign. Maybe it would have been a much worse accident. And I think that's what they were trying to bring to the table, and they failed. Unsolved Mysteries failed.
Yeah, because the reenactment shows her getting sideswiped because this budget rental truck basically is like speeding down. But I think they were trying to say if she was in the middle, she would have gotten just plowed over.
Like what they should have had is the truck flip after it hits her and say the brakes had gone out on the truck.
Yeah, even that would have been like, oh my God, she did it. Like I would have believed, but the reenactment failed this one.
Yeah, definitely. But she's still around, and I hope she still has a connection with her sister or brother. I'm not really sure if it was identical. But yeah, I don't. After watching this, I brought up to my wife, I'm like, can you imagine if we had twins? Like, we had two Ramiels walking around. I mean, they'd be named differently, but.
Right.
I'm a little bit more creative. I can come up with a second name, but it would be too much. I don't know how parents do that.
I don't know.
One and done for me. One and
done. And my God, triplets. Oh, yeah. Like, it's only crazier from there.
Yeah. And I'm like, you know what? If he had a twin, he would be like some jock, and I wouldn't like him.
Well, I'm sorry. I know we are kind of running long, but that Andy Garcia, he had a twin, and he was born with the twin, like, attached to his shoulder.
No way. Andy Garcia, the actor? The
I'm
super
pretty
handsome
positive
guy?
That this is true. Yeah, and that he had, like, his conjoined twin's head on his shoulder or something. I've heard that.
I just had to do a search. Yeah, it's been reported the Ocean's 11 star. Really? That's the best you can do is Ocean's 11? that's, like, 20 years ago. He had a twin the size of a tennis ball attached to his shoulder, and the twin had to be surgically removed. Of course, Family Guy spoofed on the deformity. But they spoof on a lot of things, like Little House on the Prairie. I wonder if they've spoofed on Unsolved Mysteries.
Well, there's only one way to find out.
Yeah, it seems like it would be fodder. But, Kim, I'm sorry that we're running late. My stories, they never end. I have a story for everything. But but you do, too. So.
I know, and I appreciate your stories, and thank you guys for joining us. If you wanted to leave us a feedback, we would be so appreciative. Yeah. It would just help people find us, and we will send you a very cool Unsolved Mysteries Rewind official tinfoil hat.
One more. Make it up.
Tonight, we have been confronted with an entire catalog of unexplained and unsolved events. Tune in next time as Unsolved Mysteries Rewind discusses another collection of unsolved mysteries. Until then, we can only look and wonder.